Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. That was the observation that was behind the Scott Fitzgerald short story and the more recent film, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. You might have seen that film. It's a film about a man who ages backward. So he's born in his kind of mid-70s as a small but aged child, and he moves through life in the exact opposite direction to the rest of us. He goes from old age to middle age to his 30s to his 20s. Then he goes on a great journey of discovery as he travels around Asia as an early teen, and then dies and fades into death as a child. It was based on the observation, apparently, that Mark Twain gave to Fitzgerald, saying it's a shame that the way they run life, all the good bits are at the start. It's strange, isn't it? It's an observation that youth is, in some sense, wasted on the young. But at the very point that you're wisest and most learned is at the same time that your body is least likely to be able to do the things that your wisdom tells you now should do. We're given our best energy when we know the least, and our least energy when we know the most. And something about that just seems kind of wrong and cruel and the way the world is. Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. Well, today we try to bring together the writing on Ecclesiastes and think about what we've been thinking about over these past few weeks. And we want to turn our attention to a figure that is not entirely in the background, but certainly not in the foreground, that is God. The writer of Ecclesiastes, as is clear on the way through, is a believer in God, perhaps a slightly gothic, emo, left-of-centre believer in God, but a believer in God nonetheless, and he wants to draw our attention to God. But I guess in a way that's predictable, he wants to draw our attention to God in a slightly strange way. And he wants to have our humanity at the centre, to think, what do we as humans, how do we relate to God, especially given the passage of time? When is the right time to know God? We're going to end up at the end, but I wanted to start back and notice some comments in chapter 3. There's a very famous poem in chapter 3 that you might know from a pop song, where the writer says, "There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven. There's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build." And so on and so on and so on. The kind of poem or song goes on and on about this fundamental observation that there is a right time for things, that there's an opportune moment, and that part of the wisdom of life is to seize that moment. It's an interesting question to ask whether that poem is happy or sad. At one level, there's a kind of sad beauty in it. The way the attractive rhythms of life work, the way there's rest and work and summer and winter and sunset and dawn and night and day, the way we find ourselves at a time of year where there are Christmas parties and a sort of easing of the workload, at least in some cases. It's a beautiful thing when someone knows when it was the right time to give you a hug or to say a tender word, when a tense moment is broken by a well-placed joke, or when a silence is observed where that's exactly what's needed. And I think we find those tokens of grace in life, and yet the poem has a sadness to it, because it says that God has made everything beautiful in its time, a celebration of the timeliness of things, and yet he goes on to say, he set eternity in our hearts, and yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. And we're back to Benjamin Button. Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. God has set eternity in our hearts, and yet none of us can fathom, none of us has access to the beginning and the end, to the way our lives will end and to the way this world will end. It's frustrating as a human to have that sense of wanting resolution, of wanting to know the meaning of things, of wanting to understand how it will all play out, and yet not having access to that knowledge. Not knowing when the right moment is to tell the joke or to remain silent and so on. And so at the end of the book, the writer sort of gathers this up as he wants us to think about God and starts to talk about God and time, knowing God as a human. I'll work backwards in the poem. The poem at the end is about ageing, which perhaps is a depressing prospect. But he wants us to think about God in the context of the way our lives move. So he says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. This isn't written down, but trust me, and you can look it up on Google when you go back to the office. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come. That's his less than romantic sense of what it is to age. It's the days of trouble. Before that time when you will say, I find no pleasure in life. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and strong men stoop. It's a brutally honest and somewhat depressing vision of old age. He's talking, I think, about, it's a poem about the body of an old man, and he uses these metaphors to describe it. So he talks about the keepers of the house, that is the legs of the old man, and the way the legs of the old man stoop, the way they struggle to hold up the house of his body. He goes on to say, when the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows grow dim. Got the picture? You've got the legs holding up the house, you've got the house, and you've got the grinders, which are the teeth. And he talks about the grinders growing few, as the teeth of the old men, at least in that those days, would fall out and you were reduced to drinking soup. Those looking through the eyes grow dim. This is the idea that there's little people in your eyes, and the old man tries to look out of his eyes, but they've kind of gone all foggy and cloudy, and he can't see the world that he looks out on. When the doors of the streets are closed and the sound of grinding fade, people rise up at the sound of birds, but their noise grows faint. The old often rise early in the morning, and you hear you're awake before the birds are awake. This is also true of people with young children. But the old, you rise and you hear the sound of the birds but your body isn't there ready to do the day's work. My grandma, I think, could become an advisor to the UN for the amount of Radio National she listens to at night time, because she can barely sleep. But as her mind has accrued all this knowledge from Radio National, she's probably better informed than Barack Obama. She's at a time in life where she can't do anything about it. Sorry to bring you down. In verse 6, he says, remember him. Before the silver cord is broken, before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered and the spring and the dust return to the ground from which it came, and the spirit returns to the God who gave it. It's a vivid and sad picture of death, where the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken. And so the teacher ends, as he always does, by saying, vaporous, vaporous, everything is vaporous. And it's all just so depressing. But the writer, I do not think, writes to depress us. He doesn't write to make you sad. I think he writes to teach us wisdom. That is, to give us wisdom as we think about our life and where we stand with God. And he wants us to think of that in the context of who we are in time. The Bible, like most wisdom, normally advocates delayed gratification. You know, this idea of delayed gratification where, presuming you all agree that the icing's the best part of the cake, then there's some wisdom in leaving the icing till last so that you can most enjoy the thing at the end rather than at the beginning. And there's wisdom in that, of course, and you'll do well in life if you observe that. But the teacher, the Minority Report, comes in and says, you know, that strategy could backfire. You see, what if you decide that old age is the time to get into opera, or to start painting, or to run your first City to Surf? What if you wait till then only to discover that the very time you want to discover opera, you can't hear it? At the very time you want to get into painting, you can't see it? At the very time you want to get into running the City to Surf, your legs won't carry your body the distance? Now, I'm 36, and I don't know how that strikes you. It feels very old to me. It might seem young to you. But I'm aware that even at 36, you could fill a massive shed with the things that I will never do. My dream of getting into the Olympic gymnastics squad, for example, is something that I've just got to say, that ship has sailed, and I need to let it go and move on. Learning another language to fluency, winning Young Australian of the Year, they're all gone. I'm older than most of the bands I listen to. If I ever got invited backstage, I think I would feel like a fan, but I'd look like an uncle. I'm older than most of the footy players on the field. And tragically, about 2 years ago, I started to pay attention to what I eat. 0 to 35, whatever I wanted. Maccas, the lot, lollies, anything. Never the healthy meal option at Maccas. Never went near a salad. But now I'm on some ridiculous diet because it occurred to me a couple of years ago that I was a spare rib away from cardiac arrest. And life is like that. It's just this long process of wet concrete getting harder and harder, of a thousand possibilities becoming a very small set of concrete actualities. I could have married anyone, I could have worked anywhere, I could have lived anywhere, I could have done anything. But I'm a pastor, I'm married to Susan, I've got 4 kids, and they're all boys. A thousand possibilities have become a tiny set of concrete actualities. And many of the things that I dreamed about in my youth will never happen. And we live in a culture that deeply wants to reject that. Botox and breast implants, affairs and midlife crises, these are all attempts for us to reject what is so obviously true, that we are born and then we live and then we die. And we want to develop industries and methods by which we keep our youth alive forever. And we can't. And we know it. And so just as he's all rather depressing about old age, he's very upbeat about youth, which is anything under 36. Life is sweet, he says, and it pleases the eyes to see the sun. However many years you've got left, let him enjoy them all, but let him remember the days of darkness, because they will be many. He says to the young, you who are young, be happy while you are young. Follow the desires of your heart, and whatever your heart sees, follow. I bet you're glad that guy isn't the counsellor at the school that your children go to. He says, banish anxiety from your heart and cast trouble from your body, for youth and vigour are ungraspable, vaporous. They go quickly. He says to the young to be happy, to seize the moment of youth while you have it. He says to, later on in the metaphor, to ship your grain across the seas and invest in 7 or even 8 ventures, no matter what may come, because you do not know the future. He counsels a high-risk strategy for life, to seize the moments that are given to you, because you do not know when they will come again. The teacher understands that youth, like everything, is not our possession to grab, but a gift to receive. It's a vapor that when you try to own it, it eludes you, but as a token of grace, you receive it in the moment. He doesn't say youth and health are for indulgence, but he does say they are for heroism. You don't know where disaster comes, so seize that moment while it's there. He says to banish cynicism from your heart. This writer is kind of pessimistic, but he's not cynical. He says that if you want to oppose something, then oppose it passionately. Suggest an alternative and move it forward. But don't be embittered and paralysed by cynicism. Which is exactly what Jesus said. Jesus, in the New Testament, said, I tell you, don't worry about your life. Consider the ravens. They don't store or reap, and they have no storeroom or barn, and yet God feeds them. How much more valuable are you than birds? Who by worrying can add a single hour to his life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest? See how the words of Jesus and the words of the teacher are kind of in sync? Because you're not in control, banish the anxiety from your heart that pretends that you are. Now, you hear all that, and I guess it's from a religious text, but it's somewhat secular, that is, anyone could understand it. But the writer ends up by grounding his teaching on time and youth and health and age in God. And he says that the result of meditating on the way life moves so quickly ought to be to fear God. To fear God in the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible is that simple process of saying God is God and I am not. Of saying to God that you are who you are and I am your creature. And that process, which sounds so strange to say fear God, leads to liberty, but that's precisely what is promised. Because we get so agonized by things that we are not in control of, rather than acknowledging our place as God's creatures and handing over to Him the control of the universe so that we can play our part in His world. In chapter 12, verse 1, he says, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth." It's interesting that that in our society, I guess, if anyone gives any concern to God, it's almost the exact opposite. The when question is almost the exact opposite. That we would say, well, the retirement village is the time to remember your God. That it's when you retire, that's the time as you travel around Australia or do that tour of Europe. And it's as you walk into the cathedral, age 78, that you'll presumably find God and make your peace with Him. He says, youth, health. Now is the time to know God. And by youth, he doesn't just mean young. He just means now. That at the moment that you can hear and understand the claims of God, that is the time to pursue God. That is the time to know God. The last 5 years or so, I've seen a massive explosion in the new atheism. Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins have invigorated and reinvigorated the debate about the existence of God. And I'm kind of thankful for that, because it's put God back on the agenda in a way that hasn't been true for many years. But one of the things I've done is I've kind of read these guys and researched them. I asked the question to myself, how did they become atheists? What was their conversion story? And here's what I discovered. Almost all of them had a profound conversion experience to atheism in their youth. My favourite one is Ricky Gervais. He's the public atheist, but more famous as a comedian. He became an atheist at age 9. He tells the story that he was drawing a picture of God as a 9-year-old, and then his brother walked into the room and he said, "What are you drawing?" And he said, "I'm drawing a picture of God." His brother said, "God doesn't exist." And his mother said, "Michael, no." And Ricky Gervais said at that moment he knew there was no God. Christopher Hitchens became an atheist in primary school because his teacher put forward what I admit was a pretty thin argument to say that God exists and is good, because most of the world is green, whereas if he'd made most of the world purple, it would be ugly to the eye. Philip Adams became an atheist when he was 5 and discovered there was no God. My point is not whether they are right or wrong in their conclusion. My point is simply, notice the power of youth. Ricky Gervais, age 9, Hitchens in primary school, Adams, age 5. A whole direction of life and belief and behaviour were set in motion, not as they were considering in retirement whether or not there was a God, but at that moment of youth, at that moment of health and vitality. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says that now is the time to know your Creator. While you can hear, while you can understand, while you can investigate and prod and research, God is not a retirement project. The writer says that God is for now.